Thank you, June and Suzanne and everyone who's supporting this weekend. It's such a delight to see you. I see so many familiar faces. I see people I don't know also, and you're really very welcome to this weekend, and I hope that it's beneficial for you. It's somewhat astonishing in these times when people are so physically separated and some people so physically isolated that we can still come together in this way and see each other's faces, hear each other's voices, and really perhaps have a sense that, community continues, just like the Dharma continues. And so many people have said to me that, even in this rather strange format, and truly, how much the Dharma has been a refuge over these very difficult times and helping us to remember. I think helping us to remember what we value, what is important for us, the ways that we can connect not only in the with the teaching, but also with this sense of sangha or community. So I want to give you just a little bit of a taste of how we're going to offer these 2 days. I will be offering some teachings. As you know, this is not a silent retreat. This is a teaching weekend. And the theme of this weekend is the treasures within. The seven limbs of awakening. Many of you will be perhaps more familiar with the term the seven factors of awakening. So I will offer some teachings. There will be some time for questions or reflections. Brock has very kindly offered in the middle of the session to lead a half hour walking Qigong movement session. Just so that we're not just sat down for 3 hours. After that, I will be offering some more teachings, and there will also be another pause moment for any questions. And although this might feel a style of teaching that's very much from the front, I'm really tuned in to your faces, your body language, your attention that you kindly offer. So really have a sense of, participating in this together, even though it's front loaded. I really actually really rely on your listening and your willingness to be here and to explore this material together. I wonder if we could just take in the beginning just a few minutes quietly to sit together and to gather ourselves. To collect ourselves. Feeling your feet touching the ground. And settling into the body. Inhabiting the body of this moment, however it is. Inhabiting the life of this moment. However it is. That sound of sense of groundedness, of earth. Of wakefulness. And of kindness. Appreciating that we undertake this practice our own well-being, but also for the benefit of those that we care for and love, for the people that we may struggle with, and for the many in this world that we don't know. Who live like us in these times of challenge, these times of invitation. May all beings find peace in the midst of this. May all beings abide with kindness in the midst of this. Thank you. So over these days, I'd like to reflect upon these seven qualities. The word in Pali for these qualities are the bhujangas. The bhujangas are the qualities that incline the mind towards awakening. I'd like to begin by offering a quote from the Buddha, where he says, this noble life we live does not have gain, honor, or renown for its benefit or for its goal, or for the attainment of virtue, concentration, or knowledge as its goal. But it is this unshakable liberation of the heart that is the goal of this noble life, its heartwood and its end. I think it's very important to contextualize these teachings on the bhujangas, the qualities of awakening, and to bear in mind that liberation, nibbana, unshakable deliverance of the heart is really at the core of the Buddhist teaching. We are engaged in a path of awakening, a path of waking up. Not just as a goal, not just something on a very distant or seemingly impossible horizon, but as a process and a path, something that we live. And as we begin this exploration, I think it is useful for us all to reflect on what does awakening or waking up actually mean to us? What does it mean to you? And when I reflect upon this for myself, I find myself appreciating and longing for a way of living that is no longer governed by compulsive patterns and habits that tie us to distress, including the patterns of greed and hatred and delusion. When I think of this process of waking up, I think of it as learning to live in the light of what we most deeply value and understand to be worthy and wholesome. Peace, kindness, compassion, ethics, and understanding. Learning what it means to be an embodied human being. When I think of waking up, I think of it as a process of increasingly learning to see life as it actually is, no matter how unpalatable that might feel to us at times. The universal teachings, the universal principles of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness, the universal principle of impermanence and change, conditionality and non-self. To be free, the Buddha put it in the Satipatthana Sutta. He says, to abide independent, not clinging to anything in this world. This does not describe a state of dissociation or indifference. We are all deeply touched by the world of conditions, and we need to be deeply touched by the world of conditions if we're going to find appropriate responsiveness. But we can learn not to be a prisoner and not to be a hostage of the world of conditions. If we are honest with ourselves, whether we practice this path, you know, in more formal traditional settings, or whether we have been introduced to this path through more contemporary mindfulness teachings, I think we would probably all agree that we don't undertake this journey to remain the same, or to be more intimate with our struggles, or to be a spectator, an increasingly mindful spectator upon our own disasters. This path, as is taught by the Buddha, truly does invite a radical change in how we see, how we live, and how we respond to life. As the Buddha put it, he says, you know, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and that there is an end to dukkha, an end to greed, hatred, and delusion, and an unbinding from patterns of confusion and reactivity that fuel distress, despair, and reactivity. The Buddha was truly concerned with people finding the ways to be free, to flourish, to be caring, to be creative, to be engaged, to be responsive. Waking up, it's a truly noble aspiration. But I think we would likely agree that the path is not always easy. Sometimes there's even an attractiveness in being more numb or more dissociated or more asleep. But it is not an easy journey. And for any of you who've been in this practice for some time, you will know and probably have met moments of true joy and peace. And you've probably also met moments of despair and doubt. Because I think we appreciate the challenge of emerging from a habit-driven, compulsive life into a way of being where we do flourish, where we are the creative, compassionate, insightful beings that we have the capacity to be. As we undertake this journey, I think there's an invitation to really ask ourselves, what are our allies? What are our friends in this journey? You could even ask yourself, in over these last difficult months, what have you really drawn upon to sustain you and to nourish you? What have been your allies that support you and that incline the heart towards awakening? And here we come to this list that you find referenced many, many times in the early texts, the Bhujangas, the Pali word for the seven limbs or seven supports of awakening. The bow part of the Bhujangas derives from Bodhi or liberation. And Anga is the Pali for limbs. So these are the limbs that form one body. They operate together. They're an extended happy family. They support each other. And the Bhujangas describe the seven qualities or capacities we already have. And I think it's really important to name that. We're not trying to import something that is not already present within us. These are qualities or capacities that we already have. They are not alien to us. And what we learn to do is to identify these qualities, to appreciate them, and to strengthen them, and to bring them to maturity. In the early texts, these qualities are referred to as an inner wealth, or the seven treasures that protect us against pain, adversity, and that incline the mind towards awakening. The Buddha said that when these seven qualities are cultivated and brought to fruition, they free the mind and heart from all forms of bondage and suffering. And they incline the mind towards nirvana or liberation. When we begin to reflect on these qualities, it's important to acknowledge that there are two parts to them. One of them is that they are pathways. They are dedicated, intentional pathways or practices that we cultivate. And they are also fruitions. If we were to ask ourselves, what does the mind of a Buddha look like? That mind would be infused with these qualities. Another way of looking at these qualities is as them being nuances of mindfulness, different dimensions of mindfulness. So let's just name the seven, and you don't need to keep them completely in mind, because as we go on, I would like to sort of look at each of these qualities individually, and hopefully by the end of the weekend, you will know them. By the way, this is a list that I recommend memorizing. This is something to keep close to us, to bear in mind, and to remember that we can indeed access these qualities in any moment. So the first of these qualities, it should be no surprise to you, is sati, the Pali word for mindfulness that we actually see at the beginning of many, many lists in the Buddha's teaching. Sati, that we translate as mindfulness. The second of these qualities in Pali is dhammavicaya. This is investigation of the dhammas. The third of these qualities is virya, which is courage and energy. The fourth of these qualities is piti, joyfulness. The next of these qualities is pasadi, tranquility, serenity. The next of the qualities is samadhi, collectedness, gatheredness. And the last of these qualities is upekkha, or equanimity. Just a few quotes from the Samyutta Nikaya in praise of the Bodhisattvas. The Buddha says, just as the rafter of a peaked house slopes and inclines towards the roof peak, so too, when a practitioner develops and cultivates the seven limbs of awakening, they incline towards nirvana. Those who have undertaken the seven limbs of awakening have undertaken the noble path leading to the end of dukkha. Nuns and monks, I do not see even one other thing than these seven treasures when developed and cultivated that lead so directly to the abandoning of all that obstructs awakening. So you get a sense, I hope, of how much value the Buddha placed upon these qualities and these potentials that we all have. Now, you will come across a school of thought that will actually kind of see the cultivation of these seven treasures as being a path of cultivation primarily undertaken on a meditation cushion or in formal meditation. But I think there is plenty of evidence in the early texts that acknowledges, as we would all also acknowledge, that confusion and distress are not experiences that we encounter only in formal meditation. But in life, with everything that it brings to us, and it is in the midst of the lives that we live, that we learn to be awake and to call upon our allies to guide us on the path. So the cultivation of the of these qualities is in the classroom. It's in the classroom of confusion. It's in the classroom of distress that we all meet in this life with its 10,000 joys and sorrows. I think it's clear to all of us that most of the understandings we come to and most of the changes that we see in ourselves, we don't find or meet in the most idyllic moments of our lives. But that our deepest call, our deepest invitation to cultivate the wholesome and the liberating are actually in these moments that are troubled, these moments that are challenging, the moments that are sorrowful. Just as the Buddha was incredibly clear in identifying the awakening qualities, he was also very clear in identifying the primary patterns, universal patterns, that also live within us, that are the manifestations of greed and confusion and ignorance, and that lead to the perpetuation of confusion and ignorance. I often think of the Buddha as being a map maker, you know, and that's really what many of these lists are about. You have to remember that in the times when the Buddha taught, this was an oral teaching. And the way that people remember the teaching was through memorizing these lists. So as being a map maker, the Buddha offers us these lists that outline pathways of cultivation and also very much are there to name what it is that really brings distress and struggle and pain. It's a way of naming, having a language for what we experience. And having a language for what we experience, I think, helps us to actually identify what we're experiencing on a moment-to-moment level. So in Pali, the word for these, and I would stress that these are personal patterns, but they are very human and very universal patterns that create and perpetuate distress. So the word in Pali is nivaranas. Many of you who've been in practice for a while will have heard this word translated as the hindrances. It's a word we're most used to using. It's maybe not the most accurate word, and sometimes I'm not sure that it's also the most helpful word. If we translate the nivaranas, it means to veil, to throw a veil over. If you were to throw a veil over your screen right now, you know, you would kind of know that there's still a screen there, but it would be distorted. You wouldn't be able to see it clearly. So this word nivarana sometimes is translated as a veiling effect, an obscuration. So the Buddha describes these universal obscuring or veiling patterns. Very simply, he says these are the creators of mental illness and distress. He says they are the patterns that are the primary saboteurs of our most noble intentions and values and aspirations. These are the patterns that make us forgetful, forgetting what we value, forgetting what is possible for us. They lead us away from freedom, and they bind us to compulsive activity and reactivity. They distort our capacity to see things the way they actually are. So let's name these five universal patterns. And as I name them, I'm somewhat confident that you will probably recognize them in your own experience. This is not going to be news to any of you. Sensual craving. Oh, how we want things to be more pleasant than they are. Oh, how much we want more pleasant sensations, sights, events, experiences. How we get so busy with sensual craving. That's the first of these qualities or patterns. The second of them, ill will, aversion, dislike, not wanting. The third of these patterns, sluggishness, numbness, dullness, dissociation. The fourth of these patterns, agitation and worry. And the last of these patterns, skeptical doubt. I'm sure this is not news to anyone. What is, I think, a worthwhile question to explore is that if we are not aware of these patterns, it is possible that we may actually be unconsciously cultivating them. We may actually be unconsciously practicing them. And if we go to the teachings, I think there's a couple of lines from the early teachings that, stay with me so strongly. And the Buddha says, whatever we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does the mind incline. That what we frequently practice will surely grow. Isn't it true that if we really practice ill will a lot, we just get better at it, don't we? If we practice agitation and worry a lot, we will become expert worriers. If we practice craving a lot, we will just increasingly make our home in that domain. And if we practice doubt a lot, that too will be where we abide. I think we should never ever, I think many people who've been on retreats, they often kind of think of these patterns, something that you get a hit of in the first day or two of a retreat, and then you get over them so that your practice can really begin. Not so. Not so. We should never underestimate the power of these patterns we call the hindrances or veiling powers, because they so prevent us from living the life that we truly wish to live. They so prevent us from responding appropriately to the world around us. And so much of what we most deeply value is sacrificed in the face of these veiling factors. They sabotage compassion, mindfulness, equanimity, and they leech joyfulness and responsiveness for our lives. But it doesn't mean, it sounds a very bleak picture, but these are not life sentences. And just because something has a long history doesn't mean it has an equally long future. I think one of the, a life of awareness tells us that we have choices. And one of the greatest gifts of mindfulness is being able to choose where we place our attention and the quality of attention we bring. In this moment, you can choose to attend to the pain in your back or to attend to listening. You can choose to attend to the palm of your hand or to the faces you see in front of you. We discover that we can choose to feed and attend to these seven qualities of awakening, that we can choose to feed and tend to these treasures within that lead to liberation, rather than feeding the five patterns that lead to distress and confusion. This is a moment-to-moment inquiry that we bring to our thoughts, to our moods, to our speech, to our actions, to our choices. What are we cultivating in this moment? What are we embodying? What are we feeding? It is such an important reflection, because the cultivation of these qualities, conscious cultivation of these treasures, rather than the unconscious cultivation of the veiling patterns, is life transforming. Transforms the shape of our hearts, transforms the shape of our lives. And it truly is a present moment process and a present moment cultivation. There is not a better moment for this. There is not an ideal moment or a perfect moment for this better than now. Now, it is interesting then that when the Buddha speaks about these five veiling patterns, he speaks of them as being the five most visible faces of greed, hatred, and confusion. And he speaks of greed, hatred, and confusion as being the three visible faces of avidya or ignorance. So I think it's really important to appreciate that the size of this inquiry and the size of this reflection, because this is taking us really to the very heart of the teaching of liberation, to understand what binds us to distress and to understand what unbinding looks like on a moment-to-moment level. Now, some of you will be familiar with the Satipatthana Sutta, one of the, you know, really seminal primary discourses and teachings on mindfulness. And in the fourth way, you know, the first way of establishing mindfulness is in the body. The second way of establishing mindfulness is in the feeling town of experience. The third way of establishing mindfulness is in the mood or the mental state of the moment. And the fourth way, in the fourth way of establishing mindfulness, what you see, and this is true of all the different translations, actually is the only thing that is constant through all the different translations of the Satipatthana. What you see are these two lists standing side by side. The seven treasures, the seven bhajangas, and the five veiling factors. And I think in seating these two lists together, I think what the Buddha is actually describing, he's actually, I think, exploring the tension of waking up. The tension that I think is invariably involved in the waking up process. And it's so important to see the relational nature of the bhajangas and the veiling factors, that these are, it's no accident that they are sitting side by side. Consider this in your own experience, the way in which these, what's held within these two lists almost seem to pull us in very opposite directions, very opposing directions. We can see that the veiling factors exert a pull. They exert a force that pulls us more and more in the direction of greater confusion, greater entanglement, feeling lost, feeling overwhelmed, feeling dissociated. Have you ever felt that when those veiling factors are really activated? How you can just feel overwhelmed and lost within the busyness and the landscape of ill will, the obsessiveness, the rumination. These are big story generators. You know, the veiling factors are major narrative generators. And they are also, in the early teachings, referred to as self-builders. This is how we build a sense of who we are, rooted in these veiling factors. We can sense when these are operative, how they sabotage our most wholesome intentions to be kind, compassionate, generous, and awake. They make us forgetful. I think of these veiling factors as factors of forgetfulness. They make us forgetful, don't they? In the midst of the craving for sensual pleasure, we become quite forgetful about generosity or spaciousness or anything that is wholesome in the grip of ill will. Don't we just become forgetful of kindness and compassion? In the midst of a storm of agitation and worry, don't we just become forgetful of our capacities for calmness, for stillness, for spaciousness? And in the storms of skeptical doubt, of course, we become forgetful of our potential and possibilities of human as human beings. And in a wave of dullness, numbness, dissociation, we just become forgetful of everything. We're just not here. So these veiling factors pull us into this direction of forgetfulness. Whereas actually what we see with the bhujangas, these pull us in a totally different direction of unbinding from confusion. They deepen wholesome intentions, and they deepen our capacity to sustain those intentions of compassion, responsiveness, equanimity, and engagement. They remind us experientially of what it is that we most deeply value, and they give us confidence in our capacity to be awake. Just as we should never underestimate the power of the veiling factors, we should also never underestimate the power of the awakening factors when we commit to their cultivation. It is through their cultivation that truly the shape of our heart, the shape of our mind is transformed. The shape of our life is transformed. And we grow into that capacity we have to be flourishing, insightful human beings. We taste the taste of freedom, not as some idealized goal, but a freedom in the moment. So let us look at this creative tension just a little bit more. I think we all have aspirations. We all have longings for the beautiful and the good. We have our aspirations to be compassionate, insightful, responsive human beings, able to engage skillfully with the world that also has its 10,000 joys and sorrows. We have ethical values. And I think many of us would share in truly a yearning to be awake. So we have this, these deep longings, these deep yearnings, and we also have quite remarkable capacities at times for confusion and to be driven by compulsive and addictive behaviors, to struggle and to feel lost. This is the tension that lives within us all. This is the tension of waking up in this path. This is the differing voices that we all hear arising in our minds and hearts. It is very easy to regard this as a negative tension. And I think especially for people on the path, you know, there's something of a tendency to become quite judgmental in this tension. You know, we get up in the morning, you know, with the intention to go into our families or our lives, you know, as kind, as patient, as generous as we can possibly be, you know, until the bus is late, for anybody who still catches buses, but until something goes wrong in our lives, you know, and then suddenly we see all of those intentions suddenly disappear. You know, we have the intention to be, you know, compassionate and patient, and then, you know, we come across somebody who we just struggle with or dislike, or the computer breaks down, or the car doesn't start. And how often we see those most noble intentions seemingly just vanish in a moment. And we find ourselves in familiar places, of blaming or angry or upset or impatient. And I think, for people on this path, it's so easy to become judgmental in this space. I should be a better meditator. I should be a kinder person. I should be more forgiving. I should be more patient. And look, I've blown it again, and so it's impossible for me to wake up. It's impossible for me to cultivate this path. I don't feel that this is a negative tension that exists between these lists. I feel it's a creative tension. It's in the midst of the five distorting or veiling factors that we cultivate the capacity we have to draw upon, to identify, to develop, and to bring to maturity the capacities that we have for awakening, the Bhujangas. It's in the midst of this tension that we learn about unbinding, that we learn about unbinding from these habitual patterns of compulsion, of reactivity that can have a long history. But their sustaining in the moment relies upon them being fed. I think it's so important to acknowledge that there is nothing that we experience in our consciousness, in our hearts, that has an independent self-existence. For any mood to continue, for any pattern to be sustained, it actually needs to be fed. And when it is not fed, there is no nutriment for its continuity. This is so important to acknowledge. Okay, so hope you're still with me. You're still with me. Good, 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 good. So I want to actually look at what is it that feeds these difficult patterns? I mean, clearly, on a more evident level, it's often thought that feeds difficult patterns. It's identification, it's clinging, it's narrative, it's not wanting. And the Buddha was quite clear in just actually listing what is it that feeds difficult patterns. And this is also important to identify. The first of these is obvious: lack of mindfulness. When mindfulness is not present, it is almost as if we have free range patterns of reactivity. I think we would acknowledge that. So, lack of mindfulness, forgetfulness, heedlessness. The Buddha refers to this as heedlessness. We're not taking care of the moment. Forgetfulness is a bigger landscape. It's forgetfulness also of the universal laws of change, the conditionality of all things, the reality that everything is unstable and unreliable and is incapable of providing lasting happiness. Forgetfulness of non-self, that an independent self-existence cannot be found in anything. My experience and I know I'm not at all in this experience is that living within this pandemic has for many people been such a powerful wake-up call and such a powerful return to these core teachings that sometimes we just have wanted to forget. But none of us have those illusions anymore, do we? We all know that our worlds can crumble in a moment. We all know that we never were pilots in the cockpit. We all know that, life is truly a process of change. It's almost as if the camouflage has been stripped from many people's lives. And that is a painful waking up. It's not an easy waking up. It's a painful waking up. And then we might remind ourselves of what does that waking up offer to us? What does this offer to us as we emerge from a life of times of pretending or ignoring or forgetfulness? Maybe it offers us the possibility of peace, of compassion, of freedom. Another of the factors that supports these veiling factors is a lack of restraint. And I know restraint is not really a very popular word in our culture, you know, gets used interchangeably with suppression and, you know, holding back and withholding. Restraint in the Buddhist tradition is the greatest act of kindness for ourselves and the greatest act of kindness for our world. Because we know how easy it is to go through a single day in pursuit of the pleasant sensations, or not restraining even, you know, some of the most vindictive narratives or the obsessions or ruminations, not feeling skilled or resourced to know how to restrain our own hearts and minds. We know what it is like and how easy it is to give authority to our prevailing mood and the reactions it gives birth to. And this is actually one of our major changes in this path, isn't it? That we learn to give greater authority to our deepest intentions rather than to the most predominant mood of the moment. So a lack of restraint is a direct way of supporting unhelpful patterns. Unwise attention, dwelling upon what doesn't serve us well, dwelling upon what doesn't serve us well. Our ruminations, some of our narratives, our guilts, our blames, dwelling upon what doesn't serve us well. And the last of the factors, and perhaps one of the most powerful factors that feeds the veiling factors, is said to be doubt, skeptical doubt, doubt in our own possibilities, doubt in our own capacities. And I think for many people in this path, this is one of the deepest hurdles to see through, that so many people have just riven with doubt about their own capacities for liberation, for waking up. Whereas actually, this is the heart of the Buddhist teaching. This is the third ennobling truth. And I think it's so important to remember that the Buddha always sought for graduates. He never sought for perpetual followers. He offers these teachings so that we, as individuals, no matter what our doubts are, that we can come to the same liberating insights that he came to in his own path. And it is so important to remember that. So if we have in mind the factors that support the veiling, you know, the qualities and patterns that support the veiling factors, then we also come to look at what is it that supports the treasures in our own hearts that lead to awakening? The first of these, again, unsurprisingly, is mindfulness, sati, learning to attend, learning to be here wholeheartedly, sensitive to what is going on within us and what is going on around us. Second of these supporting factors is learning to live in the light of our understanding of impermanence, insubstantiality, and what leads to distress. I feel it's really significant to acknowledge that insights are not something we have. Insights are something we practice. Insights are something that we live. And what does it mean for us to live in the light of our understanding of impermanence? I know we all would agree intellectually and conceptually, but what really is the invitation of that insight? Isn't it such a powerful invitation to not cling to anything in this world? To not try and make anything stand still for us? What does it mean to live in the light of our understanding of insubstantiality, of conditionality? We know this, you know it. So it's not something news to us. The Buddha's teaching is very rarely news to us. We all know that we can't get up in the morning and insist and guarantee that the sun will shine today, or that we will have only lovely people in our lives, or that we will never age, and that we will never sicken, we will never die. We all know this. And what does it mean to live in the light of that understanding? To live in a way that we're not seeking for certainties, for guarantees. That we're not seeking for ways to defend against life. Buddha talks about the supporting factor of developing skillful attention, not grasping at sensory impressions or our associations with them, our stories about them. Instead, attending to what we most deeply value and understand. And the last of these supporting factors is really to trust, to have confidence in our capacity to flourish and awaken, even in the most difficult of circumstances and times, to have trust in the path we're cultivating, the path we're walking on. I actually think this might be a good time for a pause moment. That you're not just listening to me. Let's take a little bit of time for any questions or reflections or anything that's not clear to you. And as was mentioned earlier, you can trigger your raised hand, or you can go into chat. And I would like to hear from you.
A little more instruction from June. So those of you who would like to ask a question and speak to Christina, you can put your raised hand feature up, and then Suzanne will call on you to unmute yourselves. And those of you who are just still formulating a question in your mind and don't want to speak, you can put that into the chat. But Christina would like to hear your voices. So please be brave, someone.
Okay, so we have Phil and Chris. Phil and Chris Machine, I'm not quite sure who is there. Are you happy to unmute yourself? Thank you.
I've unmuted myself. This is Chris from Sydney. Hi. Yes. In the list of the Bhujangas, what can you restate again what the second Bhujanga was?
The second Bhujanga is... Second Bhujanga is investigation of the Dhammas, Dhamma Vichaya in Pali. And I am going to unpack them one by one, because that is the one that often sounds a little bit more obscure than
yes.
some of the others.
Yes, I'm not as familiar. Thank you. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
I'm seeing a raised hand from Sheila Wincup.
Yes. Asked her to unmute herself.
Hello. Thank you, Christina. Also a simple, but not so simple question. What is the fifth factor that you listed after joyfulness?
Tranquility. Passivity.
Tranquility.
Yeah.
What is the Pali for that?
Passivity.
Passivity. Thank you.
Yes, Colleen. You need to unmute yourself, Colleen.
Hello.
just locating Colleen in the participant.
Great. Thank you. Hi, Christina.
There you are.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to hear you again. I've been reading Ajahn Chah's... And just referring now to when you were saying when you learning to live in our and understanding the light, in living in the light of anicca.
Yeah.
Then the necessity not to cling to anything in these times.
Yeah.
And not seeking ways to defend prominent worldview or the existing. Ajahn Chah in his book, in the end of his second chapter on samadhi, talks about challenging himself to sit in the charnel grounds because he wants to sit with his fear. And I'm just finished reading that, and I get what he says, to really practice. You need to really practice this. At some point in the next little while you're with us, if you could speak to how one practices not defending a sense of solidity and stability in the middle of, particularly of a period of time now. It just seems like a natural thing to want to cling to some sort of stability right now because it's all around. But that's what he says, to practice. Thank you.
I think it is important to recognize that impulse and that very human impulse to feel safe. You know, so I think when we speak about not defending, this is not a sort of a recommendation for foolishness or for abandoning all the measures you take in order to be safe, because that is not only for you, it's for others also. But I think in terms of, you know, in the midst of the most difficult times in our lives, not clinging, not defending feels the hardest thing to undertake. But I also feel that it's important in the body, when we look at these lists and when we go through these lists, we actually see that these are ways of resourcing ourselves. These are ways of resourcing ourselves inwardly. And I think the tendency, the impulse to cling and to defend and to fear thrives when we are under-resourced.
Christina,
part of what we're doing in this undertaking is actually developing the capacities that allow non-clinging as a natural fruition, rather than as a command system, which really simply doesn't work. And I hope you'll appreciate that as we go along, this way of resourcing ourselves in the midst of dukkha, because this is where this path was always cultivated. Brian, sorry.
Yes, Christina, we have a question in the chat asking, could you please repeat the ways of establishing mindfulness?
Okay. In the Satipatthana Sutta, the four ways of establishing mindfulness are establishing mindfulness within the body, establishing mindfulness within the feeling tone of experience, the hedonic tone, the pleasant, the unpleasant, that which is neither, establishing mindfulness within the mood or the mental state of the moment. And then the fourth way of establishing mindfulness is in, as it's portrayed, offers these two pathways of the veiling factors or the awakening factors.
So that was a question from Bela. I'm not sure how to say your name. Maybe you'd like to say something to Christina.
Am I unmuted?
You're unmuted now.
Thank you, Christina. That was me, Bulo. I missed the fourth one as you were saying this. I had feeling, mood, so body, feeling, mood, and then
these two lists of the awakening factors and the veiling factors.
Okay, thank you so much.
I mean, in Pali, the translation of the fourth way of establishing mindfulness, you know, offers a whole bunch of lists of these two lists and then the Four Noble Truths and the Five Aggregates and so on. But the only thing that's constant between the Pali translation, the Chinese translation, the Tibetan, the Sanskrit, is actually these two lists of the awakening factors and the veiling factors.
Thank you so much.
I'm asking Trish to unmute herself now.
Great, I think I'm unmuted, yes?
Yes, Trish, I can see you.
Thank you, Christine. I wonder if you would talk a little bit more about the creative tension between the two lists versus just the negative tension that we tend to assume is there.
Well, it may not be a negative tension for everyone, but I think it's a deep source of frustration for many people when on the path, when they find themselves, you know, again and again forgetful of what they most deeply value and aspire to, and again and again finding themselves caught in habit patterns that they would truly love to see the end of. And so it's very easy to sort of develop that kind of negative slant, you know, oh, I've blown it, I'm not capable, you know, ending up in places far from where I wish to be. But I think we do need to reorient, because you know, that, you know, it's just like on retreats when people say, oh yeah, my practice is going to begin when these hindrances go away. Actually, your practice never begins when the hindrances go away. This is the classroom. And we need to see that it's always, this pathway is always being relational in every aspect. You know, kindness is developed in the midst of ill will. You know, calm is developed in the midst of agitation and worry. And this is the creative tension. This is where the invitation sits, you know. What are we actually going to feed? What are we actually going to develop? And actually to find joy, to find joyfulness in being able to make those choices, to actually cultivate that which liberates, and to celebrate the moments when we recognize one of the veiling factors. Ah, my old friend aversion, you know, or my old friend agitation, that we can acknowledge it and recognize it, but recognize that that is sufficient. That recognition is sufficient. And we actually don't need to throw logs on that fire. You know, we can recognize it. And then in the midst of that, cultivate whatever of the bhujanga factors, or yeah, whatever the bhujanga's limbs is helpful in that moment.
Thank you.
A question from Ocean now. Ocean, you can go ahead and unmute yourself.
Oh, hi, Christina. Thank you so much. I loved what you said about the lack of restraint being a greatest act of kindness towards ourselves. So I just wanted to share that. It really totally reframes that. Desperately trying to restrain from eating chips, and maybe if I would have thought of it as an act of kindness, I would have been more successful. But I was curious when you talked about that we don't have insights, but that we could actually practice insights, so I'm just a little bit trying to wrap my mind around that and what that would look like, insight as a practice. So I'm just wondering if you could say more about that.
Yes, thank you for the question. Well, you know, if you really think about it, and all the teachings that you've listened to, you know, most of the Buddha's teachings are not new to us. You know, it's often touching upon ground we already know. The first time you actually knew about impermanence was when some Buddhist teacher mentioned it to you. You know, you probably knew this. I doubt if, your first awareness of dukkha was when you heard about it in a talk. You know, we've grown up with these teachings. They're in our bones. But we obviously see there's a big difference between knowing something and living it. You know, and, you know, of course, part of what the formal practice does is provide an environment where some of that knowing can actually sink into our bones. and become something of a more immediate understanding, you know, and a more immediate understanding. But then there's this next step of actually practicing those insights. You know, when we come up and get in that moment, you know, where our mind is saying, oh no, I'd much rather go to the fridge than my cushion. You know, maybe I practice not entertaining the craving for sensual pleasure. You know, when we see our encounter with a difficult moment and we see the familiar waves of aversion or reactivity or not wanting, maybe practicing kindness means to stand in the ground of kindness in those moments and to actually see what it is, to actually not just focus on the narrative, the critical narrative, but actually, can I see this person in their fullness? Can I see them in their entirety? You know, when we see the mind beginning to go into spaces of contractedness, of rumination or obsession, you know, maybe we practice the understanding that this is what leads to distress. And maybe there's a way in that moment that we cultivate calming or that we cultivate spaciousness. So it's actually learning to actually practice what we know. It's interesting when the Buddha speaks about the path of awakening to understanding, and he says, the first step is always to listen to the teaching. This is actually really important. You know, I know this was quite transforming in my life as a teenager, was to actually hear a view of the world which was so different than anything I'd ever heard before. You know, I grew up in Canada also, you know, and I grew up in, you know, an environment where, you know, most everybody I knew or encountered was out hunting and fishing and doing all those things, you know. And it wasn't until my first teacher said to me, you know, maybe there's a way of protecting life. I thought, my goodness me. You know, it was another way of seeing. So the first is always to hear the teaching. You know, when I heard the teachings of compassion, possibilities of compassion rather than rage, this was like radical. So to hear the teachings, to have an intellectual agreement with them. So it's also important that we intellectually agree. It makes sense to us. You know? To explore the teachings in our own experience. Do they ring true? And then, of course, the next and the most important step, well, maybe not the most equally important step, is to actually embody the teachings, to live them. This is really where we come to be an embodied human being, isn't it? Where there's an integration of our deepest intentions in the present moment, with our thoughts and our words and our acts and our choices. This is where we feel that we, when we meet those moments, we know these are the moments that we thrive in. You know? These are the moments where we feel most alive, when there's that sense of this integration, this meeting together and what I call embodiment, rather than disconnection or fragmentation or even just good ideas. I hope that gives you, it's about choosing what path you're going to walk in any moment. You know, I think of, you know, so many moments in our life where we're kind of standing at a crossroads, you know, and dukkha is a crossroads, you know, struggle, distress, unsatisfactoriness, pain, loss, you know, and we all live to some extent at the moment in the landscape of loss, you know, the loss of so many things. And I think of it as a crossroads, you know, and at that crossroads where dukkha lives, we're actually going to choose, if we're fortunate enough to have the resources inwardly, we're going to choose what pathway we're going to follow. And we're either going to go on that very familiar pathway of, you know, the reactive patterns, the veiling patterns, you know, that lead to more and more distress, or we're going to choose the pathway of mindfulness and its extended family, you know, of not only of the awakening factors, because the other part of the extended family of mindfulness are the Brahmaviharas, the kindness, the compassion, the joyfulness, and the equanimity. And clearly there is some crossover between these four noble abidings and the seven limbs of awakening.